A sham, a mockery, a charade. Was it really? The charge of sham, mockery, and charade came from the Reverend Dr. John H. Teachin, addressing the press after he was suspended from office as president of Concordia Seminary. Dr. Teachin was one of the principals in the strife which afflicted the seminary of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, together with the president of that body, the Reverend Dr. J. A. O. Price. Many have charged that all the troubles the Synod presently faces stem from a personality clash between these two men. It is this chronicler's humble opinion that there is more involved here than mere personalities, although I would be loath to eliminate that facet to the struggle altogether. It is not the intent of this article to determine whether or not Teachin's charge was accurate, rather to determine whether or not a sham, a mockery, and a charade is an adequate way to describe the press coverage of the events which afflicted the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod from January 74 to May of the same year. There is a tremendous background to the whole affair. The history stretches back at least until 1962, the year when the Reverend Dr. Martin Charlemagne was dealt with in convention because of some publications which were deemed un-Lutheran. Perhaps the background goes further back. However, we will limit our consideration to the time span of January 1974 to May of the same year, for it was at this time that all hell finally broke loose, if you will. It is my intent to chronicle the events of those 5 months, but not merely to provide a history, a task I would not dare attempt. The scope of the study is to provide an insight into the media's involvement in the whole affair in order to see if it employed integrity in its coverage. I also would like to convey some of the emotions which were swirling around the St. Louis Lutheran scene. Our story begins with a convocation held in the chapel of Concordia Seminary immediately after the students returned to school from the Christmas holiday. Dr. Teachin was giving an update briefing. As we eavesdrop on the convocation, we have to wonder how seriously the faculty and students of Concordia Seminary regarded the board of control of their school. The board made a simple request to some professors to reshape the syllabi of their classes according to seminary guidelines for syllabi. This request really touched the funny bone of the seminary community.
The board of control dealt with the materials, the syllabi that had been submitted by
Dr. Teachin elaborated further on the agenda for the next Board of Control meeting, and this too became a humorous event.
The board has a radical agenda for its January meeting. There are almost 3 weeks worth of work for the board to take care of in this next meeting. On the agenda are a number of protests and requests from various groups, official and unofficial, including the faculty of the seminary and the students and the student administrative council, requesting particularly a review of actions that were taken at the November meeting. On the agenda also are requests for appearance from a number of officials of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. They will also have to deal with contract renewal for 5 executive staff members, with the tenure matter that was on their agenda at the October and November meetings, affecting a number of faculty members who are presently on tenure, according to the bylaws that were established by the Senate at New Orleans. They will have to be dealing with their implementation of policies concerning retirement, and there are a good number of red blood items that require their attention. And then, of course, there is also the report that will have to be presented by the chairman of the Board of Control, concerning his dealing with the bylaw provisions regarding implementation of charges against So I do continue to worship soul. We'll have something to do in the course of the day and a half evening with the schedule.
One cannot help but wonder whether or not all present had a realistic picture of the church's angst about the affairs of Concordia Seminary, or whether they even saw that this was really more than a game. Perhaps this evaluation is unfair. It stems largely from a personal observation about the theological academic world. It seems to consistently be about 10 years behind the scenes. In reviewing the actions of the individuals who became seminarists, I consistently saw Berkeley students of the 1960s all over the place. What was the vogue back then, burning the ad building, striking, picketing and all, became the scene at 801 DeMunn, with crosses in the quad, blocked entryways, and inoperative Carolines. Keaton seemed to become quite a bit more serious as he looked into the future, for he was reasonably confident about what it held for him.
I had asked to teach two reasons the day of theological reflections in January. I would simply like to express to you my deep appreciation for the maturity and the great responsibility which you exercised in the course of that day and in your subsequent acts. I also want to express to you my own personal gratitude for the action of many of you in the letter which you addressed to Board of Control and the extensive pastors of our church. And copies of letters to your actions that I am receiving indicate not everybody understands the situation I have handled, or your motivations, or the reasons that led to the actions which many of you took. But there are indeed other people who do understand and who are recognizing the importance of the actions which we took. I think such an indication is reflected in the recent editorial decided to the position center. And I want you to know that I thank God for the bonds of faith and love which unite us together as a seminary community. It is still difficult to know, and why it's meant for us as an institution. We have the opportunity to do what we think we need to do, as God gives us the insight to take whatever actions we need to do necessary. And we trust that we will work out all the time.
Waiting for Dr. Teachin was a suspension from office. When the suspension was revealed, Teachin reacted to a news conference in which he affirmed his own integrity and deplored the lack of the same on the part of his persecutors. Keaton labeled the proceedings a sham, a mockery, a charade.
I stand committed to my ordination vow, reaffirmed at the time of my installation into my present office. I accept without reservation the scriptures of the Old and the New Testament as the written word of God and the only rule and norm of faith and of practice, and the Lutheran symbols comprising the Book of Concord as a correct and unadulterated statement and exposition of the Word of God. I also stand committed to my pledge to carry out the responsibilities of my office as seminary president. I do not object to evaluation of either my faithfulness to my confessional commitment or my performance in office. I have no doubt about the outcome of a fair and impartial evaluation. However, the present proceedings being conducted by the Board of Control on the basis of Bylaw 6.79 offer no possibility of a fair and impartial judgment. They are the result of collusion between the President of the Synod, the six majority members of the Board of Control, and my two accusers. They are a charade in which my two accusers and the majority members of the Board are seeking to fulfill the letter of the bylaws for the purpose of reaching a predetermined objective already publicly announced by the President of the Synod to remove me from office and from the pastoral ministry of the Synod. I cannot participate further in sham proceedings without sharing in the mockery that is being made of the bylaws.
The students voiced their support of Dr. Keaton by declaring a moratorium on classes. Student body president Gerald Miller read the moratorium resolution at a press conference.
We, the undersigned students of Concordia Seminary, therefore resolve, 1, to declare a moratorium on all classes until such time as the seminary board of control officially and publicly declares which members of the faculty, if any, are to be considered as false teachers, and what scriptural and confessional principles, if any, have been violated. 2, suspend our class hours until the seminary board of control informs us of its decision, communicating to the board of control and to the synod at large what we have been taught at this seminary, especially the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. To complete our academic requirements for those classes which we will miss, according to procedures which are acceptable to those who are responsible for course accreditation. We make this resolve, mindful of the possible consequences of our actions, and asking God's blessing upon our labors.
The faculty also declared a moratorium. Professor Robert Bertram explained to the press,
"In no sense is this a resignation. And I would want to say, if I might anticipate a question, leader, do we want this to be construed as a strike? We don't want it to be construed as self-suspension. The point of fact is that the board, by suspending President Teachman for the confessional stand that he has taken, has by that action condemned our confessional stand as well. And the board knows very well that his and our confessional stands are the same." Well, that may be a matter of judgment. I guess we're not seeking a stand which is, first of all, bold. If it's bold, fine. What we are trying to do is to seek a stand which says something to the members of the church about what the realities are.
To the press, the action on the part of the faculty seemed to be half-hearted. As illustrated by the questioning of KMOX's Julius Hunter, it was neither bold nor sheepish, only unclear. For 1 week, the seminary struggle was the highlight of the news in St. Louis, with new developments breaking regularly. The next bombshell to surface after Teachin's suspension was the revelation of a deal rendered in his behalf. Teachin called the deal immoral. Chuck Connor reported about it on KFUO.
Dr. Teachin told the news media he turned down a deal by which he would not have been suspended from office.
Persistent efforts to arrange a deal have been going on for the past 2 months. The terms proposed to me were as follows. If I would agree to accept a call, arrangements for which were being made through friendly district presidents, a call being another position as pastor of a congregation in the synod, none of the faculty members over 65 years of age would have to be retired. Professor Paul Getting, who was not reengaged at the November meeting of the board, would be reengaged. A 1-year moratorium would be declared on all efforts to remove faculty members, and the charges preferred against me would not be pursued. In response, I made it clear again and again that I would not be a party to such a deal and could not even consider another call as a pastor as long as the present charges against me remain in force. I consider the proposed deal to be immoral.
Dr. Teachin was charged with teaching false doctrine and malfeasance in office. He says he will not personally take the issue into the secular court. Meanwhile, Dr. Martin Charlemagne has been named acting president of Concordia Seminary, and students are boycotting classes in protest of the suspension and have virtually closed the campus of Concordia Seminary. The faculty majority has lodged its protest with the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. J.A.O. Preuss. The faculty members have suspended themselves on the same basis that their president, Dr. Teachin, was suspended, and they're pressing Dr. Preuss for a statement. So the conflict and controversy in the embattled Missouri Synod goes on. There has been no comment thus far from Dr. Preuss, president of the 3-million-member church body.
The next day, Dr. J.A.O. Preuss also held a press conference in which he tried to explain the deal.
Churches, including the Missouri Synod, have moved in the direction of contracts. Contracts are in process now, on the order of the day for virtually all canonical employees. They began in our schools years ago when they began to have 2-year and 4-year contracts. And now they're even beginning to be applied to assistant pastors and so on. The reason for it being that in the resolution of conflict, which arises among even the best of Christians, there's never been a good way to do it. under the divine call system. So the result has been that you've developed a kind of a under the table arrangement whereby I get letters, I would say at least one a week from some congregation saying, would you please help us get rid of our pastor by getting him a call to another congregation. This, to use the expression, is standard operating procedure.
Conditions at Concordia Seminary were sad. Moderates labeled it a battleground littered with atrocities. Conservatives saw it rather as the recuperation after a much-needed operation. The most accurate description is to call it a ghost town. The first acting president, Dr. Martin Charleman, called on the students to return to their classes.
So on Monday, classes were resumed, and students are asked by the board to go to their regular classes, and professors are asked to be present in those classes to teach them. I have sent to each professor on the faculty a letter in which this is stated. I have indicated to each one that classes will resume on Monday morning, that we will be on a regular work schedule at that point. I have no idea how many will be there. We will simply have to see. Now, if they do not show up, if you come to class and they are not there, then of course we will have a new situation. Very frankly, we haven't thought that far, because I want you to know that the Board of Control work on the assumption that we are dealing with mature and responsible people, both within the student body and in the faculty. And it even refused to consider any kind of talk about what comes afterwards. They assumed that their request would be honored. And I hope that we are right and that this will actually take place.
The majority of students did not return to class. Stressing their call to minister now, a great number of students left campus to plead their cause before the laity of the church. Operation Outreach lasted 1 week and touched a great part of the whole nation. Seminarian Chip Miller told the press all about it.
But in general, the greater majority of the people that we spoke to were very enthusiastic, very concerned, or very interested in the fact that they were finally getting some information. We also were very cautious not to say, we are 100% right, we have all of the answers. We don't. We were presenting as much information as we had. We were encouraging them to find out everything that they can from both sides, from everywhere. I can only speak from a personal standpoint. I benefited very, very, very greatly from this whole situation. Until the situation is cleared up, our moratorium was stated that until such time as the Board of Control speaks out on this and clears the air, we would not return. And I would assume that that would still stand. Hopefully, the people out in the congregation would have the sway to encourage the Board of Control to clear the air on it, and then we would return.
KMOX's Penny Crone asked the question that the whole church wanted answered, when will you return? A return then already was not in sight. On his evening news show at KFUO, Chuck Connor summarized the situation to date.
The Missouri Synod standoff continues in the battle between moderates and conservatives in the nearly 3 million member denomination. For more than 2 weeks now, only two professors and a handful of students have been holding classes at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. In recent action, the Reverend Dr. J.A. O'Proyce, president of the Synod, issued a four-page letter to the seminary faculty charging them with staging theatrical protests in support of their suspended president of the seminary, Dr. John Tejan. Dr. Proyce accused them of promoting rebellion within the church. He stated that he will not back down on the suspension, and he called Dr. Tejan, quote, theologically and temperamentally unfit to head the seminary, end quote. The majority of the Concordia Seminary faculty have mailed to churches throughout the Synod their response to Dr. Proyce's latest charges. The faculty majority say the Synod president has abdicated his role as chief pastor of the church. They maintain that the doctrinal dispute which threatens to split the church is being encouraged by Dr. Proyce. The faculty charges that Dr. Proyce in issuing his latest statement, is pursuing a course leading straight to a split. They said it pits brother against brother until one wins, one loses.
To celebrate the students' return from Operation Outreach, the moderates gathered at Christ Church Cathedral in downtown St. Louis for a service of thanksgiving and praise. There were many speakers, among them the Reverend Professor Paul Harms of Concordia Senior College in Fort Wayne, Indiana. An excerpt from his address serves as a good outline for the moderate position over against the controversy.
The adversary is what is that secret, and I would suggest that in the power of God and Jesus Christ and the power of God and the Holy Spirit, Christ would do a new humanity by running all the hostilities to his enemies and could reconcile you and Gentiles, standing in the altar, reconcile Christians and
At a rally about the same time in support of Concordia Seminary, Senate President Dr. J. A. O. Croy defined the conservative position.
Now, above all, and I find this in the Atlantic District in southern Illinois and all over the church, the thing that holds us together and the thing that gives our people their loyalty to their church is not just people, not just institutions or organizations, but it is this wonderful doctrine which we have preached and taught on the basis of the scriptures and the Lutheran confession. We want, above all things, to be a church body which can say, as Luther teaches us to say, that we teach God's word in its truth and purity. And I know that everyone here, and I know this is true of the overwhelming majority of our pastors and teachers and our people, we want to remain that way and are going to make every effort to do so. This is something that we cannot compromise. We can talk about conciliation and efforts to bring people together. I'm very hopeful that the Committee on Doctrine and Conciliation, which has been formulated, will help to clarify issues and to help us. But we do know what we believe. I think we know what we want, preached from our pulpits and taught in our schools. And I assure you that despite the attacks and the unpleasantness and sometimes the loneliness of the job, that as long as I am the president of the church, we are going to do everything we possibly can to keep our church on the firm foundation where we've always stood.
No matter what vantage point one takes while looking over the controversy, one observation must be universal: the failure to communicate. Both sides were using the word reconciliation, and the moderates claimed the administration meant by that total submission, while the conservatives claimed the moderates meant by that unquestioned tolerance. One source of the controversy was the New Orleans Resolution 3-09. Even this was unclear until the Commission on Constitutional Matters spoke out on it and made way for all to reshape their perspective on the seminary problem. Senate Press Secretary Joe Eisenhower reported the CCM's findings.
One ruling states, quote, Resolution 3-09 does not condemn the doctrinal position of the faculty as a whole and or of each faculty member, but rather condemns the position defined as the stance of, quote, the faculty majority, end quote. In another ruling, the CCM stated that, quote, charges against faculty members must always be made against a specific member or specific members, and not against a group not identified by name, end quote. Thus, the faculty is assumed to be clear until specific charges are brought by name. The CCM also ruled, quote, that under Resolution 3-09, the Board of Control is now obligated through an interview process and through a study of the documentation which has been developed to determine which faculty members hold positions rejected in Resolution 3-09 and to deal with them according to those procedures provided in Bylaw 6.79, which are pertinent. End quote. No condemnation can be considered as having been made until this procedure is complete and applied to specific individuals. The CCM ruling also points out that each faculty member has the option to declare, quote, that the positions rejected in Resolution 3-09 are not his personal positions, and that, therefore, Resolution 3-09 does not apply to him.
On the 18th of February, the Board of Control delivered its ultimatum to the students and faculty to return to the classroom. Dissident faculty and students refused to comply with the directive unless the board first met its own demand to return the whole affair to status quo before the New Orleans Convention of Synod. Doug Nicely of KFUO interviewed Professor Robert Bertram.
Dr. Bertram, today during the day we had the news report that the faculty majority refused to comply to an ultimatum ordering them back to the classrooms. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes, that's true. The seminary's Board of Control, in an action which it took last evening, served notice to the faculty majority and executive staff this morning that we had until noon today to comply with the order from the board ordering us back to class, or if we chose not to do that we would thereby be terminated. Salary would be cut off retroactively to about a month ago. People who occupy homes on the seminary campus would have to evacuate those homes by the end of this month, 10 days from now.
And then tomorrow, I guess it's planned for the students to meet at 8:30 in the morning?
Yes, that's the plan of the student body. And they'll be resolving upon their own course of action at that time. The expectation is that students and faculty will resume instruction tomorrow, though not on this campus. Nevertheless, the instruction we would be continuing would be very much the same sort of thing that we've been doing here at Concordia Seminary, the only difference being perhaps at a different location, though not under the control of the present administration.
The standoff between the administration and the dissidents crystallized in the formation of Seminex. Reporting for the Church Today, Don Lanier said,
in a dramatic moment Tuesday, nearly 600 students and faculty of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis voted to leave the school and begin what they're calling a seminary in exile on two nearby campuses. The students and faculty marched across the campus, placing small wooden crosses in the lawn, each bearing the name of a faculty member or a student, giving the quadrangle the look of a graveyard. Classes for the new seminary in exile began Wednesday morning. And with that story, here's Steve Prinkman of KMOX, St. Louis.
The troubles at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Clayton took on added dimension at the middle of this week when dissident students and faculty members officially broke away from the school to form their seminary in exile. The interim Concordia administration insisted at the start of Seminex classes that student work was not valid and exiled students couldn't be recognized by the church. Exiled students not registered for Concordia classes for the spring quarter have been told to vacate seminary housing by March 4th. Officials at Eden Theological School in Webster Groves and St. Louis University, where exiled classes are underway, tell a different story. St. Louis University Divinity School Dean Father William Sullivan says accreditation officials were consulted thoroughly, and they'll certify work of the exiled students, even though, as Father Sullivan put it, it's out of the traditional educational mainstream. Attempts at resolving the dispute continued into the weekend with another so-called conciliation forum. A similar forum last weekend failed to make progress. And whether this one will produce positive results, for the time being, remains to be seen. This is Steve Trinkman for the Church Today.
Any place away from St. Louis sounds very peripheral throughout those 2 months in 1974. Special district conferences were called to address the issue, and some moderate district presidents called for a new synodical conference. The real result of all this was prayers for reconciliation and resolutions urging both sides to talk. There were many press conferences during the time. At one, moderate leaders Sam Roth and John Dom talked about the effects of the controversy.
My experience has been that people, in witnessing the kind of courage and faith that's been demonstrated, have had their faith strengthened. We've had people from many other denominations who have supported us not only with their words, but even with their money, because they have appreciated the witness of faith which these people have given. I don't feel that it's been harmful at all. I think it's been helpful to the community. Maybe John can add something to that, Dr. Dom.
Just that I would think that history kind of bears that out. Probably some of the most fruitful periods of the church came as a result of some controversy, some great turmoil, or some great upsetment that had occurred, either within or without the church, but that affected it. And so I think many people are happy that the whole thing is out in the open and that we can begin to deal with it creatively.
Concordia Seminary kept on plugging in spite of everything. Acting President Martin Charlemagne reported it on the beginning of spring quarter.
Well, spring quarter, as you know, has begun on a very fine note outside in the weather. Our enrollment is up to 83, which we think is considerable. We thought for a while it might be somewhat less. We're quite happy about the enrollment. interesting thing that intrigues me a great deal is how these men, who in a sense have been a kind of minority among us, are assuming leadership and blossoming forth as people who will be a great credit to the church.
For a while, the synodical struggle was moved to a back burner, but the pot boiled over again over the issue of Seminex grands and vicars. Missouri District President Herman Scherer explained to John Lanier of the Church Today the problem in dealing with the candidates.
President of the Missouri District, Herman Scherer, who says synod rules require that all graduates be certified of a synodical synod. Then he added,
realizing that these young men are gifts of God to the church and the church desperately needs their services, it would be my hope and it will be an effort on mine also to try and work around the bylaws of our synod so that they can be certified and be placed as workers in the church.
So you wouldn't reject them out of hand because they've attended seminary?
No, because I still consider them members of our synod. I still consider them brothers in Christ, and it's unfortunate that we have this situation, but I will do everything in my power to try and place them.
Scherer refuses to predict how the credentials dispute will be resolved, but he says as leader of the Missouri district, he will work within the synodical structure rather than outside it.
The problem was compounded by uncooperative Seminex men. KMOX's Steve Trinkman reported.
Second-year students at the seminary in exile in St. Louis, ready for vicarage assignments similar to student teaching positions, have rejected out of hand a suggestion from Dr. Jacob Preuss that they register for the assignments at the Concordia campus. Dr. Preuss, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, proposed in a letter to second-year students that they register by a special deadline which passed unheeded this week. Dr. Preuss says all parties have agreed to place second-year students based on work they've done up to the end of the winter quarter before Seminex became a reality. Seminex placement coordinator Paul Lessman says students take sharp exception to that statement.
It would be their contention, first of all, that not all parties have agreed that any kind of allowance like this should be made. And secondly, they are feeling that legitimately they're completing their sixth quarter right here at Seminex, and on the basis of that, they will be placed.
Lessman adds the district presidents of the Missouri Synod determine how placement is to be handled and fully expects efforts to block placement of second-year students in a Chicago meeting next week. But he adds he's ready for that.
I would guess that there will be some attempts. And, of course, we're trying to anticipate such attempts, and our feeling is still that in one way or another, Seminex vicars will indeed be placed on March 22nd.
Lessman says Dr. Preuss and acting Concordia president Dr. Martin Schroneman are apparently confused over the placement issue because of their efforts to register second-year students at Concordia, not Seminex. The entire placement issue could be settled finally in that Council of Presidents meeting in Chicago next week, which begins officially on Monday. This is Steve Trinkman, KMOX Radio News.
Finally, the CCM ruled all Seminex men ineligible unless they met with the faculty at 801. Seminex men were placed anyway, although some had to forfeit ordination or recognition by the church as a legitimate clergyman. Between May and October of 1974, a little affair in the Episcopal Church about some women took over the limelight from the LCMS as the number one religious news story of the year. Our Civil War was the number one story for 2 years. Things were very quiet until October 15th. On that date, Dr. John Teachin was removed from his office as president of Concordia Seminary. Doug Nicely provided the coverage for KFUO.
I feel that we have in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at the present time a crisis, a confessional crisis. And it is now really made clear by the decision of the Board of Control to remove me on the grounds of false doctrine. We have said all along that the seminary, Concordia Seminary, and I as its leader, were a paradigm, a object lesson for the entire synod. What has happened to me, in a way, is an illustration of what a lot of people in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod can expect. With these words, the Reverend Dr. John H. Teachin, the former president of Concordia Seminary St. Louis, reacted to his conviction on the charges of holding, defending, allowing, and fostering false doctrine, and on 9 charges of administrative malfeasance by the seminary's Board of Control. In a press conference at Seminex, Dr. Teachin announced his intention not to appeal this ruling because he said that there was no possibility of a fair and impartial hearing on the charges brought against him. There is still some uncertainty as to who would eventually be responsible for deciding whether Dr. Teachin is to be removed from the pastoral ministry or not. The former seminary president maintained that parental responsibility kept him from attending the special session of the Board of Control October 11th and 12th, and that he had not been consulted about his availability when the special session was scheduled late in September. As for the future of what he called the confessing movement within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Teachin had this to say. We are being given the option by the present administration of conforming, surrendering is the way to say it, to the administration's present position, or of leaving the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I think what I have been trying to say to the good people of the Missouri Synod who share my same boat is that we should do neither. We should neither conform or get out. We should remain as loyal members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as I intend to do even if they throw me out of the pastoral ministry, and as I expect that there will be congregations that will provide me opportunity to do. And thus, press the confrontation. It is not possible for an administration in a church body, which is presumably run by the consensus of the people, to impose its will, ultimately, on people who will not accept it.
I wish I could say the end, but it isn't the end, for the church is still seeking a solution to this grief-enshrouded affair. Perhaps Anaheim, perhaps never. Above all, we rest assured that God will not allow his church with a capital C to pass away, and his word shall always prevail. We still have reason to hope. This tape constitutes the requirements for completion of an independent study undertaken with the assistance of Professor Martin Schmidt during the winter quarter of the 74-75 school year at Concordia Seminary. The scope of the study was to provide an insight into the way the press handled the whole Lutheran Church Missouri Synod story and to determine if the press was honest in its coverage. Let me first defend my tape. I limited it to a period of the first 5 months of 1974. The story is so broad that I was forced to place a time limit in order to make the affair workable. One could accuse it of being incomplete, and in reality it is, for I meant it not as an end-all, rather as an addenda to already existing materials. The story was of national significance, and yet I limited it to coverage only in St. Louis. One could again charge it with being incomplete. I plead my defense on these grounds. The story happened in St. Louis. Consequently, it was most extensively and adequately covered in this city. Secondly, the story pertained to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Consequently, the LCMS-owned radio station devoted the most coverage hours to it, and so most of our material was gleaned from KFUO newscasts. I am aware of the limitations of this study, but I am also confident that it has some value. I would like to conclude this work by letting the press speak for itself. First, to give an example of the general attitude of the press toward the LCMS crisis, I present an interview with Kenneth Woodward, editor of Newsweek magazine. I am aware of the fact that Newsweek magazine is not based in St. Louis. However, Mr. Woodward reveals great interest in as well as knowledge of the affair, and his attitude is typical of a large number of the press, which sided with Seminex. It's important to remember that we live in a scientific world, which caters to scientific thinking. Traditional Lutheran orthodoxy, however, does not mesh very well with today's science, so it is not surprising to hear Woodward's comments. Following the interview with Woodward is one with the reporters on two local newspapers. The subjectivity of Woodward provides a nice contrast to the objectivity of the two newspaper correspondents. Here, then, is the interview with Kenneth Woodward. I'm speaking now with Mr. Kenneth Woodward, the editor of Newsweek magazine. Mr. Woodward, how do you see the LCMS conflict, in particular the role of the administration in the whole thing?
I don't know if they speak for the Bible very well. That's the interesting thing. It seems to me that church ought to be, as a Lutheran church, very concerned about that. I would say that those represented by Dr. Teachin, while hardly being liberal, are really more biblically oriented than Dr. Preuss and his crowd. Liberals are bad losers. So are moderates when it comes to playing politics. They very often don't play very good politics, and that's what's happened in that church. If you are head of a church, as opposed to being head of a political organization, especially one as tightly knit as this one, and you label your opponent a heretic and one who's going to subvert the traditional values, you have put your man on the defensive right away. Mr. Nixon knew how to do this very well, by the way, and it has been done in this church. And therefore, the so-called moderates have been looked upon as being heretical.
Do you see any hope for reconciliation, or will the church split?
I'm afraid the split is inevitable, and the only reason to think otherwise is to recognize that this is ripping families apart. There are people who have given their life blood to this church and love it dearly. And they are not inclined to want to leave. And I'm talking about the Seminex people especially. Devoted, people who could have made a lot more money teaching someplace else. And are loath to leave something which other people would pick up and leave in 5 minutes. And because of the tenaciousness of their love for their church, that their lives hope that they'll be able to stay together in the same pew.
I'm speaking with Jim Adams of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and Karen Marshall of the Globe Democrat. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod controversy is a hard one to understand. On the surface, it looks political, but we cannot ignore the doctrinal side either. Can we, Jim?
I would certainly say that there are politics on both sides. I think we've had the argument repeated, particularly by the so-called moderate side, the more liberal faction within the Missouri Synod, with their case that it is essentially a matter of politics by the Synod president, Dr. Jacob Preuss. But I always have to keep in mind as I approach the story that there are political maneuverings on both sides, which I must keep in mind. I think the story is significant because it goes beyond just the Missouri Synod. This is an international church. In fact, I'm continually surprised by the number of readers and even my colleagues in the news business who say, how can this story get so much coverage? Isn't this just the Missouri Synod, a Missouri church? So I find that you have to constantly repeat in your story that this is an international church body, the eighth largest Protestant church in America. And what's happening there is significant beyond the particular headquarters building here in St. Louis.
Isn't it difficult, Karen, to cover such a complicated story with so many people and so many places involved?
Oh, it's very difficult. It's also very difficult to explain to your editor that the English district isn't any place in particular. It's a very complicated case from that standpoint. And it's geographically divided sometimes in reaction to the whole issue, and other times you can go throughout the state of Missouri and get completely conflicting ideas on that issue.
What does it all boil down to, do you think?
Well, that's very difficult, because I think that's the big question right now, exactly what it does. It's probably indicative of what's happening and has happened, is going to happen in a number of other churches where there's one group wanting a fairly pure translation of the Bible as they see a pure translation, and the others who don't. And in this case, it happens to be the conservatives who have control at the moment. And that's where your politics comes in to a certain extent. It's, you know, principle is fine, but there's the other kind of principle involved in building.
Do you think the upcoming convention in Anaheim will work any solutions, Jim?
I would suspect it would have to. I don't know how long you can have a bloody family feud go on with the whole world watching before one group or other has to say, this is not the mission of the church to do battle under death before the eyes of the world. So I think by this time next year, there should be some indication of ultimately where the two factions or the one Missouri Synod church is going to go.
What has the split done to the individual congregation, say, a small rural Missouri place?
Well, I've talked to some groups where it's confused them a great deal. It's complicated their lives. I think some of them would like to pretend it doesn't exist. Let us go on about our business, and we don't want to take sides, and don't ask me to take sides, just let me do it. It's much more difficult if they're in the business of trying to find a new pastor.
I would like to add to that a delightful quotation from the Globe Democrat last summer, or this fall, I'm not sure which, of a story of a rural church in the Missouri, where they were having a dilemma of selecting a seminary in exile graduate. And the halfway down the story, there was this quote from the board chairman of the church to the effect that, I wish the news media would tell us which is the right side, or something to that effect. Here we have been accused of being on one side or another, and this, in outstate Missouri, they don't see it that way.
Is the church going to survive this storm?
Oh, I think the church is going to weather just fine. It may not be exactly the way some of us would like to see it, but I think if it weren't going to get through the storms, there wouldn't be the storms in the first place. The people simply wouldn't care, and they'd fade away out of lack of interest, and that's certainly not the case.
I would generally agree. I think in the 50s we had a general era of complacency. In the 60s, as we know, we had turmoil generally. Now we're into a settling period. Still many battles going on, obviously. But we're in a settling period, a maturing period, which has always been a cycle in the church and in cultures generally. So I would say the church is certainly not dying.
My thanks to Kenneth Woodward, editor of Newsweek magazine, and to Karen Marshall of the St. Louis Globe Democrat, and to Jim Adams of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. In all fairness, it must be stated that these interviews were not exclusive, but were shared by the press. Just to briefly evaluate the summary of the events in January through May 1974, as well as the interview tapes. My goal was to determine the integrity of the press. I believe I have found and shown the press to have employed great integrity along with their objectivity. Jim Adams pointed out that he always looks for both sides to a story. And as a small-town Missourian stated, I wish the press would tell us which side is right. I believe the press would have loved to be able to answer that question, but it could not, for it was not dealt with honestly. By and large, the press reported the truth as it was let out to them. This doesn't always mean it was the truth. Professor Robert Bertram told a press conference that he would consider encouraging the fourth-year Seminex man to seek an interview, yet when he addressed the students themselves, he said, "What do you want to do? Screw us? Because that's what you'll be doing by going back there." The press is easily criticized and maligned, but when one becomes a part of them and is forced to dig for a story as they are, respect for that industry grows. Respectfully submitted, Daniel Miller.